This is AMDA On The Go, your gateway to expert discussions, journal article reviews, and innovation in post-acute and long-term care. AMDA On The Go is a presentation of the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. Support for this podcast is provided by Afoundria, the makers of ChartPath. This podcast is eligible for ABPLM pre-approved certified medical director credits. Details will be provided at the end of this podcast. And now here's our host for AMDA On The Go, Dr. Wayne Saltzman.
Welcome to AMDA On The Go. This podcast will focus on geriatric psychiatry issues in the post-acute and long-term care setting. According to the American Association for Geriatric Psychiatry, between the years of 2000 and 2030, the number of United States older adults with mental illness was expected to reach 15 million. The 2003 President's Commission on Mental Health Subcommittee on Older Adults noted that by the year 2030, there would be less than 3,000 geriatric psychiatrists, whereas the demand would be for more than twice that. These subspecialists provide a nuanced approach to care that neither primary care practitioners or often even geriatricians alone can manage effectively, including coping with change, stress, death and grieving, depression, anxiety, dementia, sleep, or agitation. But it is the management of agitation or adverse behavioral issues often associated with dementia in the long-term care environment especially that makes the geriatric psychiatrist so essential to care, especially around the use of off-label antipsychotic medication. In a 2015 Journal of Clinical Psychiatry report entitled Antipsychotic Treatment of Older Adults in the United States, the percentages of elders with long-term medication use was as high as 50%, with half of those patients associated with dementia. Yet only 20% of elders in their 80s received prescriptions directly from psychiatrists. Subsequently, there were such significant antipsychotic medication adverse issues reported, including anticholinergic reactions, Parkinsonian events, tardive dyskinesia, orthostasis, cardiac conduction disturbances, sedation, and cognitive decline that calls or even mandates to reduce the use of such medications in elders occurred with a focus on the skilled nursing environment. In fact, the Canadian Foundation for Healthcare Improvement, CFHI, implemented strategies in 56 long-term care facilities to reduce the inappropriate use of antipsychotics due to their being poor strategies for care, seriously harmful, expensive, overused, and led to worsening of cognition. And in the United States, further efforts in states like Massachusetts via regulations such as Section 72BB of the General Laws required specific and relatively involved informed written consent criteria to be placed in the medical record prior to antipsychotic administration, as well as implementation of specific staff training regarding such administration. In the ever-swinging pendulum of healthcare, where are we now with regard to antipsychotic medication? Is it useful off-label? How do we best utilize geriatric psychiatry today? How do we manage appropriately our challenging behavioral medicine patients in the skilled nursing setting, oftentimes on our own? Tough subject, but I can think of no one more appropriate to help us navigate through the world of geriatric psychiatry and the maze of antipsychotics than geriatric psychiatrist and Denver, Colorado Top Doc Award winner, Dr. Leah Watson. And Dr. Watson is with us now. Dr. Watson is a geriatric psychiatrist, teacher, and cheerleader for safe prescribing in late life. She is a clinical associate professor of psychiatry and geriatrics with the University of Colorado. She developed her own consulting and training business to extend the reach of geriatric psychiatry. Dr. Watson, welcome to AMDA On The Go.
Thank you so much for having me. It is truly an honor to be on here. This has been a really fun thing to listen to, and I'm thrilled to do it.
Oh, we're thrilled to have you. Dr. Watson, I typically like to start our discussions with somewhat of a historical perspective. At the Atlanta 2019 annual meeting for the Society of Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine, one of your colleagues from the Colorado chapter told me specifically that you saved Colorado with regard to issues around antipsychotic use and skilled nursing facility patient and resident care. There have been a number of initiatives in reducing off-label use of antipsychotics, like the Agency for Healthcare Administration, or ACA, initiative. And we know that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, are looking at reducing skilled nursing facility antipsychotic medication short stay initiation and long stay prevalence. What do we know, or what should we know now about antipsychotic use, especially off-label? And how did you save Colorado or impact the appropriate use or non-use of these medications?
Well, let me start by saying that there is a considerable dearth of psychiatrists. So the fact that I was willing to come in and do anything, I think, makes you an immediate hero, because there's so few of us. But truly, there are two main reasons that I've been given the opportunity to raise awareness and really try to bring up quality in Colorado. Namely, it's the Colorado Nursing Home Leadership. We have a very strong chapter of AMDA here. Carrie Levy, the immediate past president, is here. We've had visionary and very innovative leadership, including some colleagues like Greg Gunn and Elaine Shire and Bruce Smith, people that were willing to take the chance on me in a very innovative way by allowing me to extend the reach of geriatric psychiatry by working with systems of care and with large practices, as opposed to seeing patients one-off, which, as you know, can take, you know, a long time in the geriatric population to really to do the best work. So what they've allowed me to do is to develop a behavioral health integration strategy, number one. And then number two, we've really been allowed through a systematic overhaul of how we run psych farm meetings, which are required by CMS. It has allowed me to address quality in this much broader way. So because I'm able to be in scores of facilities, either personally or virtually across the state, and, you know, I'm in the majority of nursing homes of Colorado now, it's allowed me to actually touch thousands of residents and hundreds of primary care providers. And it's really with a central theme of trying to bridge regulatory requirements and clinical quality. And it's a simple but not easy, as they say, which is really, it's about culture change. And yeah, it's about face time, and it's about understanding the regulations, but still having a really strong respect for the fact that patients are suffering and we still have to treat them. I should also mention that, you know, the dementia care partnership that was established back in 2012 is very vibrant here, and we have partners with the state health department as well that have been invaluable in allowing us to really step up our game. The history of course, the overuse of antipsychotics started in the late 90s. They were illegally prescribed and marketed. Both Risperdal, Seroquel, and Zyprexa those companies all paid fines for illegal marketing, which actually got them prescribed in vast quantities and until 2011, up to like 24% of the population of nursing home patients was taking an antipsychotic. So that's what prompted the national partnership. And then various different initiatives have been undertaken to help reduce those numbers.
I want to talk about some of the initiatives. And in doing so, I am reminded from some research that as of the taping of this podcast, in a currently in-press Journal of the American Medical Director Association, or JAMDA, article from the Netherlands entitled Importance of Social Supports Within the Nursing Staff on Agitation in Residents with Dementia, Dr. Eva Tan and others focused on the environment and explored the relationship between facility nursing job characteristics and neuropsychiatric symptoms. They found that the weaker the facility nursing social support network, the worse the resident physical aggression. We know from your website, leahwatsonmd.com, that you have a passion in creating a culture of appropriate psychotropic prescribing in long-term care settings to achieve quality outcomes for all stakeholders. So if we think about quality, if we think about QAPI, Quality Assessment Process Improvement Strategies for reducing the burden of antipsychotics or optimizing non-pharmacologic measures in the long-term care population, and we think outside the box like these authors did, what would be your suggestion or suggestions in developing a process improvement plan, or what have you done to alter or enhance this culture of medication prescribing to address behavioral health issues in the population?
Really a thoughtful question, and I think it boils down to top-down leadership, and we have quite a heterogeneous system with regard to nursing home owners and systems of care. And it's really about setting the standard up front and people being engaged and willing to make culture change. I'll just admit readily that our biggest barrier in the long-term care space is attrition of the direct care workforce. So I think the last statistic I saw, it's like over 200% per year for the frontline workforce. So any sort of education efforts have to be repeated often and that sort of thing. But what we have found success with is really very grassroots oriented. It is identifying the strengths and weaknesses in a given facility or in a given system of facilities, and really building on the strengths and identifying barriers to care. A good example is really empowering the interdisciplinary team through the use of the psychotropic review committee meeting. So everyone comes to these meetings. I don't know if you've been to any, but it's the most wonderful space to be in because it's all the people in the building that help take care of the patient. It's the social services director and the DON, but it's also the activity staff. And we've really gotten a lot of the primary care providers to come join us. So we discussed not only the medications, but the non-pharmacologic initiatives and other ways we can improve care. Good examples of some things we've done is we have gotten a couple of facilities to really buy into the notion of having a PRN-free building. And we do that by talking about PRNs actually require someone to demonstrate a behavior or a problem before they can get a medication, which is really psychologically counterintuitive to success. Wow. So if we can develop protocols and non-pharmacologic interventions that support the staff and they can become a PRN-free building, they feel so empowered and they take great ownership of that. It requires money and time, frankly. It's about staffing ratios. It's about being given the flexibility, let's say, to do frequent room reassignments or to paint the hallways to help with wandering or to use essential oils or have a separate, more relaxed bathing space. We have discussions like that. And in my most successful buildings, it's the team of the native providers there that really take ownership over it. And I'll even have people say to me now, Dr. Watson, we don't need a med for this. I know exactly what we need to do. We need to move Mrs. Smith down the hall, and we need to not see her at the first dining. We need to see her at the second one because she does much better. And once we do that, her behaviors go down. It makes it sound a little more simple than it is, but it's really about empowering the people with their boots on the ground, and especially the direct care workforce, so the nursing assistants, and being able to have some accountability and consequences, both carrots and sticks, for people that are willing to engage in that culture change.
Wow. You know, as you're talking, I'm thinking about the discharge process for those folks who are in short stay situations. Have you done work with hospital discharge teams to make sure that antipsychotics, if they transition through, are done appropriately or less so, et cetera?
We have done some work. I'll tell you that this whole issue of hospital discharge to skilled and sometimes long-term care space really reflects some of the brokenness of our healthcare system. So as you might imagine, people go to the acute care setting for psychiatric purposes in crisis. And the goal of that team has been to do quick stabilization, which often means that people get put on multiple medications to get them settled down and in less distress. And their job is essentially over once that happens. And they're often, in fact, unaware of the regulatory environment in which a nursing home functions. Mm-hmm. And so they send us patients that are on 3 or 4 medications and sometimes even 2 antipsychotics. And so then we receive them and have to take that into account in our new regulatory environment, as well as just practically speaking. So one-off relationships can help with that. But to be perfectly honest, the disconnect is probably one of the greatest barriers we have. So the problem we have in nursing homes with antipsychotics is rarely about them being started inappropriately. It's about people coming to us on too many and too much, and then figuring out how to get them off.
Our interview will continue after this brief message from Afoundria, the creators of ChartPath. Our world is changing, and the demands on your practice are growing. Nobody wants to just buy an EHR. You want a technology partner by your side. That's why they built ChartPath, a simple-to-manage and simple-to-use EHR backed by a dedicated team 24/7 that will guide your practice through MIPS and help you manage your growth. Most importantly, ChartPath is efficient, so you can continue to give your patients the high level of care you are known for and still make it home in time for dinner.
We're talking with geriatric psychiatrist Dr. Leah Watson. Dr. Watson, as a segue to our last question, I do want to talk about the potential off-label use of antipsychotic medications in the treatment of behavioral health issues, from delirium to dementia-related agitation to terminal agitation. We know that the use of antipsychotics as a hospital sleeper is not appropriate, and believe me, it's taken years for me to convince my colleagues that that is indeed the case. But we also know that there are alternative medications being utilized to help with some behavioral manifestations in the nursing facility and elsewhere, like anticonvulsants. Assuming that non-pharmacologic approaches have been tried and have been unsuccessful and documented, where does one safely and appropriately go from there? You know, I refer to the Joe Amdas in the trenches as our colleagues. You know, where do you start when faced with a challenging patient with no real access to geriatric psychiatrists like you, and the desire not to transfer somebody to an inpatient geriatric psychiatric facility for the reasons you just mentioned? You know, assuming there is even one accessible, you know, and also, you know, having the potential of surveyors looking over your shoulder while you're initiating or trying to initiate treatment, you know, where do you start?
Yeah, this is really hard. We live in a culture where people feel helpless and hopeless with regard to these behaviors, and that's why these medications have gotten propagated. If you really look at it on its face, it's hard to believe that we prescribe medications that, number one, have no FDA indication for their use. They have data that they actually cause harm. They have a big black box around them.
Yeah.
And no data to support them, and yet we feel helpless and we use them. All that to say that I do believe there's an appropriate place to use antipsychotics, and we can talk about that a little in a minute. It's really developing for yourself an algorithm about how to approach behavioral disturbance and dementia, which is also a really good time to pause and remind folks that we have an increasing prevalence of primary psychiatric problems in nursing homes as well.
Yes.
People that live with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder and have true need for antipsychotics and very justifiable use. And it's important to remember what appropriate use is. Appropriate means it's not too much and it's not too little, and it's for the right patient at the right time.
Right.
And I think we have actually gotten ourselves in a bit of trouble for under-prescribing antipsychotics in people with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder that truly have it. And I'll sort of leave that there because I think we're really focusing more on the dementia population with behavioral disturbance. And I'll just tell you how I teach this and how I size it up for my colleagues and my peers and my students. For a behavior to rise to the level of needing a medication, particularly an antipsychotic, it needs to cause distress, and distress to the patient, not to the staff. It needs to raise to a level of safety concern that warrants it, just for risk mitigation and for common sense. So for safety and distress, those are the two reasons. So I always ask that when I get called about whether a medication should be used. And then my second question is always, is this a patient with a primary dementia, or is this a patient with a primary psychiatric disturbance? And that really helps set up the way you think about it. Clearly, you know, we know that you want to start with the least risky medication. Antidepressants also have very little, if any, data to show efficacy for agitation and dementia, and do have risks, but they're less risky than antipsychotics. And so I'll tell you, I typically would start with that, understanding there's latency of effect for antidepressants. And my preferred agents are mirtazapine, because it can be more anxiolytic and is sedating and can help have the beneficial side effect of increasing appetite in some of our patients. And sertraline, because it's a clean drug and it's well tolerated. All of the antidepressants have equal, which is none, efficacy typically in data, but those are the two safest and well tolerated. I try to avoid Prozac because it's activating and has a very long half-life, and I avoid Paxil because it's very sedating and anticholinergic and is, has a higher likelihood of a withdrawal syndrome. So that's what I think about when I'm thinking about prescribing medications. And again, it's about documentation. So there's no harm in trying something with good justification if it rises to that level. It's really about knowing when to stop it and whether the trade-off is worthwhile. It's also a good time to remind folks that, you know, the worst possible environment for anyone with dementia to be is often a sensory overloaded nursing home setting. And so it's loud, there's lights, there's sounds, there's unfamiliarity, you're having to have a roommate, you can't eat or sleep when you want to. So many of the times we're asked to treat symptoms that are manifest because of the circumstance and settings in which people are forced to live. And so it's a really tricky business to decide when it's good to treat or not. And that's why getting in there and really meeting people and getting face-to-face makes a huge difference.
Absolutely. I just want to reiterate safety and distress. I can't tell you how many times I, and I know colleagues listening, have gotten a phone call at 8 o'clock at night with, Mrs. Smith is yelling out, can we give her something?
Is there exactly. Or wandering.
Yeah. Is there a safety
or
issue?
Or exit seeking.
Or is there a distress? I think those are key questions as part of education, and I'm so thrilled that you brought them up.
And I wanted to follow up on another really important question you asked, which is what has become known as the substitution effect. So sure enough, we have gotten antipsychotic rates down to roughly 16%, roughly nationally. And all of a sudden, we see an increase in the use of anti-epileptic drugs and the gabapentinoids.
Right.
Which really have tremendous risk and cause harm in people. And so when we do a medication review, we look at the entire list of medications for potential bad actors. And I try to quantify the medications that cross the CNS and that can be potentially deliriogenic or depressogenic. And that the big offenders right now on every med list are Depakote, gabapentin, Lyrica, and then muscle relaxants like baclofen. And so all of those medications have very vague, if any, indication or data to support their use for many of the things that they're listed for. And gabapentin in particular causes depression and neuropsychiatric symptoms and doesn't have data to support its use in neuropathy. Lyrica and Cymbalta do, but not gabapentin. So and Depakote is probably the most concerning, because we actually do have trials looking at Depakote for behavioral disturbance. And not only does it not work, it actually looks to worsen cognition and actually cause brain shrinkage in one study, as I recall. Mm. And then it begins the cascade of the side effects of Depakote, which can be to your bone marrow and to your liver. It can increase ammonia, which then puts you on lactulose, which then causes diarrhea, and the traditional prescribing cascade begins. So we look at them all in order, and in my mind, the issue of safety and distress, you know, is relevant to the use of all of these drugs. Mm. So I try to keep one psychotropic at a time if I'm doing them and really address its efficacy before moving on. So serial monogamy is what I like to say, is how we approach it.
It's the geriatric mantras that we've all learned and should be executing. Start low, go slow, one thing at a time. And it's always about, or nearly always about, medications. Thank you for reminding us of that. As has been customary, Dr. Watson, in the time that we have remaining, I want to be a little provocative with you, but not really. Regarding the future geriatric psychiatry needs in our country, Even given the information provided in the introduction to this podcast, your website reports that there are fewer than 1,500 geriatric psychiatrists in the United States today. Are we going to be able to increase the desire for colleagues to pursue this subspecialty in the future? Do we need to alter medical student or residency training to accommodate for this lack of specialists? You know, how do you foresee the ability of medical teams across the continuum of care to care for and manage our growing older adult population and their behavioral health needs? And, you know, you talk about new models of care on your website. What could those be?
So this is the perennial question, of course, in all of geriatrics, about how do we recruit people to want to do this great work? How do we retain them? I think there are, you know, we need to pay for their medical loans. We need to have pay equity with other specialists. We need to do all of those things. But I think, unfortunately, the real answer is that we're probably not going to be able to keep up. And I think we're going to have to do a lot of training of the trainer. So not only are there only about 1,300 practicing geriatric psychiatrists in the country right now, 25% of them are over 65, and 60% of them are over 55. So this is a declining workforce, and less than half the fellowship slots are filling. So I think, as much as I hate to admit it, it's unrealistic to think that geriatric psychiatrists alone are going to be able to do this work. The way that we can extend the work is through new models such as behavioral health integration, which, if you're not familiar with it, really evolved out of the work of Jürgen Innitzer and Wayne Caton at the University of Washington for the collaborative care model that was initially used in primary care. In January of 17, I believe, they actually approved codes for this to be used in primary care settings, and nursing homes and assisted livings actually count as a point of service for the use of that code. 99484 is actually what I use. And it allows a large practice, one of which I work for, to bill a monthly code for basically oversight and supervision if you have a psychiatrist and a care manager and a registry base where you actually do measurement-based care. It allows you to bill this additional code to CMS for a relatively nominal fee, but at a large volume, it can pay for itself and really improve care. It's something I actually hope to talk about at the next ANDA meeting. But this has been a really successful model for me so far, and to my knowledge, not many folks, if any, are doing it in the long-term care space, and it's really a lost opportunity. Anybody with a psychiatric diagnosis qualifies, and the code gets put in under the primary care provider's name. And I'm sure you know this, but, you know, 2/3 to 3/4 of all long-term care residents and assisted living residents have a psychiatric diagnosis.
Right.
So it's very, very prevalent, very low-hanging fruit, and it allows sort of a big picture aerial overview of the medications, of the measures, and it allows the patient to still see other mental health professionals as needed, but it's this added piece of integration. So there's that piece, and then there's a training piece. And I think, you know, 23 states, I believe now, actually have nurse practitioners working autonomously, and they have little to no training in geriatric psychiatry or in psychiatry at all. Right. So I'm spending a lot of time personally now doing training for APPs and actually some physicians that work in the long-term care space, really about essentials of nursing home psychiatry and what that means. It's really foreign to a lot of people, and the risk and responsibility that they take on with some of these patients is just remarkable to me without any training to do so. So the training piece and then the behavioral health integration piece are really, I think, the two keys, and we have to pay loans back for people that go into geriatrics. We have to reward them, and I actually think we stand to really be leaders in this, and I know that the policy task force at ANDA has thought a lot about this. As we accept risk in new models, I think that more training and engaging behavioral health in any way possible is really going to improve our success in reducing rehospitalizations and hospitalizations. So I think we stand to really have a lot of optimism in this area, but it requires people to take the risk to hire somebody without direct billing for one-off encounters. And that seems to be a far reach for people. So, but it can work and does work. I'm living proof. And I think it has been really well received. And what I'm always so impressed by is the true dedication and commitment and really calling people have to work in this space. And they want to do right, and they want to do well, and they want to be educated to be the best provider they can be. And basically anybody that works in long-term care is going to be practicing psychiatry, whether they want to be or not. That's just a fact.
Amen to that. We have been so privileged to speak with and learn from geriatric psychiatrist, and may I say geriatric psychiatrist extraordinaire, Dr. Leah Watson. Dr. Watson, thank you so very much for spending your time with AMDA on the Go.
Thank you very much, Wayne. It's been great.
References for this podcast can be found at paltc.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm Dr. Wayne Saltzman for this innovation podcast that we call AMDA on the Go.
Support for this podcast is provided by Afoundria, the makers of ChartPath. If you are a physician and interested in obtaining ABPLM, pre-approved certified medical director credits for certification or recertification, please email cmd@paltc.org with your name and the podcast's title. Thank you.